You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
I'm William Ivy Long, and this is The Fabulous Invalid.
Do you want to do it one more time?
Yeah.
So we have a little more energy?
Yeah, okay. A little more energy. From the top?
Yeah.
A 5, 6, 7, 8.
Welcome to The Fabulous Invalid, a Broadway-centric podcast where we take a 360-degree view of the theater through interviews with actors, writers, directors, designers, and everyone in between. I'm Jamie Dumont, recovering Broadway marketer, personal chef, and event planner.
And I'm Rob Russo, writer and theater critic with Stage Left on NYC.
Hi, Rob.
Hi, Jamie.
You have such energy tonight.
Oh,
I love
well,
it.
Thank you. Well, I'm excited to talk to our guest.
I'm excited to talk to our guest, too, but we should also mention we're back at Orso.
Yes, our favorite restaurant in the theater district.
We are at our favorite restaurant.
At
our usual table in the corner.
You know, my parents went to see Ain't Too Proud over the summer and made a reservation at Orso, unbeknownst to me, and got here, and apparently my dad, ever the name dropper, mentioned that, you know, that I'm with this podcast and that we record here. And the manager was like, oh, of course, I'll give you their table. So they sat at this table with their friends, Joan and Charlie, who they'd known forever, and had dinner, loved it, of course, because this is such a great restaurant, and then saw Ain't Too Proud, which, as we all know, is one hell of a musical.
That it is. And I love a good name dropper. I mean,
you really need to meet my dad then. You know, he's great.
I actually do need to meet your parents. It's getting a little crazy. I don't know if they actually exist. Well, I know they do.
They exist. I do. I'm not an orphan.
Your mother is very prolific on our social media.
That's right.
I love that about her.
She's a big fan.
I actually thanked her for birthing you on social media.
How about that?
I got a laugh emoji out of her, which
and you got one out of me just now. Yeah. So there you go.
Well, you know, I have my moments.
Anyway, it's good to be back at our table. I feel at home.
You are clutching the table
in this corner.
As if it's going to run away.
Well, you can't see this, listeners, but I have the corner seat. So
yeah, you always do.
Yeah, it's a good one. And we have a great guest today.
William Ivy Long, legend.
Legend.
True legend.
Let's get to it.
Let's.
With no less than 75 Broadway shows to his credit, and work that extends to off-Broadway, regional theater, television, and film, William Ivy Long's name has been synonymous with the theater for over 4 decades. Currently represented on Broadway with last season's Tootsie and Beetlejuice, and the long-running hit Chicago, we are pleased to be joined by 6-time Tony Award winner, former chairman of the American Theater Wing, and Theater Hall of Fame inductee, costume designer William Ivy Long.
Wow. Welcome. That sounds impressive. Who's that?
I'm impressed.
Now, do you have Tito's vodka?
Yes, we do.
Ah, well, then that's all we want.
Very well.
I would love a Tito's straight up with 2 big wedges of lemon and a big glass of ice cubes.
Done.
I just mix my own.
Gentlemen.
Mercurial.
I would like iced tea, please.
Yes.
Oh, I'll also do an iced tea. That sounds fun. Yeah, thank you.
And I love that not only can you design costumes, but you can also bartend.
Right.
Well, you know, I had 2 bars on 2nd Avenue for 10 years.
You did?
Shulbred's and 9th Ward.
I didn't know
which
that.
Which I designed and owned and... I'll even tell you about them, should you ask me.
How is that not on the Google when you look you up?
See? Shulbred was my grandmother's name. Shulbred. My great-grandmother. Well, my great-grandfather's name, I guess, yes. And Scottish Bar. It was on 2nd Avenue and 12th Street.
What year was this?
And,
what time in New York are you talking about?
It ran until 2 years ago.
Wow.
And so 10 years before that. So what would that be? 06?
Yeah, 06, 08, 09, somewhere
yeah,
there.
Yeah, 06 it opened, and 08, 9th Ward opened.
Wow.
And that was right across the street. And that was bourbon, obviously, because it was from New Orleans. And I designed both of them and filled them with family pictures. And
oh, my gosh.
Engravings and lithographs from my next-door neighbor, who was Louise Bourgeois.
Oh, wow.
For 16 years, I was next to her. And yeah, and we did rather well. We ran for 10 years.
Yeah, that's a long run.
And then
longer than most shows.
Shall we just say, then strange and wonderful things started turning up about the finances that I had no idea about. So we just decided not to. Well, we weren't allowed to continue. We opened 9th Ward, which was bourbon and all things New Orleans. And it had a back garden, and it also ran for 10 years. So,
I love that you say ran for 10 years like it's a show.
It ran for 10 years like a show. Well, they are a show. You know, live theater is bartending and bar going.
Absolutely.
And is very much, it brings out the storytelling in one.
Oh, yes.
And in fact, especially if you have no sports TVs, it encourages storytelling and all manner of communication.
Not having TV in many parts of your life is not a bad thing.
I think it's superb. Yeah. Not that I haven't been proud of my live television performances and that I've worked on.
I have a question. Where are you drawing inspiration from right now?
Oh, my goodness. You know, I, that's a very good one. Inspiration from, well, I always do, this is what I do. It's sort of, to answer your question, I'm just going to blurt it out whether it makes any sense at all. But I have a smartphone number 4. And every morning, before I force myself to go to the gym and force myself to try to be a healthy human being, I indulge in my Instagram and my Google. What's the Safari? That's my favorite thing. You press
the
Safari.
Browser.
That one, right? And my Woman's Wear Daily. Hmm. And Daily Variety. But my Woman's Wear Daily brings me a great deal of joy. And especially during the collections. And I love seeing what the other part of the world is coming up with. Because people say, how is fashion different from costume design? Well, it's very clear. Costume design, we recreate a period as chosen by the director, time, place, weather conditions, age of performers, and we recreate it. We interpret it. If there's a concept, it goes through a blender. But we're basically telling a story from an exact period in time or a created imaginary time. Fashion designers, God love them, imagine the way they would like the world to look. And by that, they'd like to imagine a world that they would love to live in and what it should look like. So these are completely different whole points of view to clothing the body. So, of course, I'm so envious of the other side that every morning I see what's happening. Of course, we're in between shows right this second. But, oh, my goodness, the Paris, the London, the New York, the Milan. Oh, wow. And I follow them. And then, since I'm a Luddite and only can, I have no computer, but my computer number 4, the little one that's just recently broken, I mark down which shows I want to see, and I email one of my assistants and say, would you please print out Tom Brown's latest show from Paris, or Dolce Gabbana from, you know, Rome, or the steps of, you know, St. Ignatius Loyola.
Actual photographs of the
I want to see every single garment, because I'm only seeing 3. So, skip to, how did this help my life and change it? Last year, or about 2 years ago, how long have I been working on Tootsie and Beetlejuice? Years and years and years. But let's just say 2 years ago, when I was in the thick of Beetlejuice, and we were trying to get inside the brain of Tim Burton, because no one wants you to put a movie on the stage. Even if you wanted to, I don't think you could, because it's different. We can't make people look that good. They've got take after take. That sweat drooling down the mascara. That we can't wipe ours away. It's just going to be there. So I'm always trying to find inside the auteur, if you're taking a film from film to stage, and I have been involved with many of these transfers. You don't want to copy it. You want to homage it. Of course, I always say homage is French for stealing, but you try to homage it because that's why people want to come see it. So it's a double-edged sword. You know, yes, it's like it. No, it's not a copy. So how do you make it not a copy? I go back to the source material or to the brain. Mm. And the brain of Tim Burton is a delight to see. We all went to MoMA a few years ago when they had his one-man show, and I bought all the cocktail napkins and all the books. And all the, you know, tchotchkes. And I brought those out again. I had them Xerox and surrounded myself in my studio so that by osmosis, I would get this vibration of his very own hands drawing. There are very few interpretive auteur artists of the film who actually can draw exactly what they want to see. Mm. Now, he has a great assist with Colleen Atwood, the wonderful costume designer who interprets most of his recent work, and she and he are very have great simpatico-ness. But I wanted to figure my own simpatico-ness, so I started trying to draw like him. He draws with it's like a ballpoint pen and markers, two objects I've never used. So automatically my trying switches, because I draw with ink, pen and ink, and very soft pencil. So that's totally different from pen and ink and markers. And then I watercolor, or gouache, or light oil washes. So automatically I'm changing by my medium, my natural medium being different. So I do my work. I sometimes even assign myself, okay, copy the Mona Lisa according to Tim Burton. Well, there it is, and I'm trying. Of course, I can't do it, and that's the point. My version is going to be different. But starting with the master right in front of you is a very compelling thing to do.
So you're literally soaking up so that who is they are.
Yes, I'm soaking up what's behind, as far as I'm able, what is behind that brain. Mm. What's up there? What is he doing? And so that's how I find my inspiration in that show. And maybe that sort of implies how I do it with everything.
With your other show from last season, Tootsie, which is not a fantasy world. It's not a period piece. It takes place in contemporary. It takes place today. So how does that differ? How did you get into that show? Because that feels like you're actually creating fashions, which is the opposite of what
exactly.
You think you or what you said you did.
And in fact, I may have stumbled upon that behavior because it's cutting edge today. Well, think about what Tootsie's story is now. No spoiler alert. We don't do a soap opera. We join the very long line of backstage musicals,
right.
The making of a musical on the Broadway. And so we join Chorus Line, 42nd Street. Think about it. And this is exciting in itself. So it's sort of, I'm slightly familiar with this process. So there are two minds I have to get inside of. Not Tim Burton's. I have to get inside the mind of the director of our play within the play, played by Reg Rogers in a heart-stoppingly, breathtakingly, breathless performance, and trying to get into his brain. So how do I do that?
Well,
I'm
trying to get into
the brain of the character, not Reg Rogers is.
Right, the character of the director.
Character of the director. So,
Ron Carlyle.
Well done, Ron.
Very good.
This is a Ron Carlyle
production.
That's right.
So I try that, and I bring, by the way, also for Tootsie, I surround my studio. Oh, and I have these boards that I go and buy at the hardware store. They're either pink or blue, depending upon the density of the insulation you want for your new home. If they're pink, they're one density. If they're blue, the other. So I get the blue. It's thicker. And I paint them white on both sides. So at one time, I can have 24 whole boards for Tootsie and then turn them over into 24 for Beetlejuice. Mm. And I was doing four shows at once last year at one time. So I also had Princess Diana on another set of boards. And I had Marie the Musical, used to be called Little Dancer, by Degas sculpting the little ballet wrap. So at any one moment, it's a very schizophrenic feeling because you can turn around and sometimes when it's half done, you go, ooh, well, oh, look, there's Monet, Manet, and Degas over here, and here's Tim Burton. And it's very exciting when those disjuncts sort of blare against
right.
each other across the room.
Do you ever find that they can inform each
yes,
other?
Yes, they talk to each other.
Yeah.
Color-wise, they do. Mm. Color-wise, they do. Tim Burton only uses a few colors. So when you, and one of the things I did, I would take Xeroxes that we then cut I'm such a Virgo. You cut the little white edges off the Xerox because I can't stand someone else putting a limit on that image.
Right, yeah.
You know, which is what white borders do. Mm-hmm. They're limitless, so I don't want to see those white borders. So we cut them off. And I try to collect as many of the, I say Monet, Manet, Degas, Renoir, friends mm-hmm. at those periods, and I pull the ones in the same colors and put them up against Tim Burton. It's it's a surprise. It's a real surprise to see how different colors are used on the human figure, and which colors Tim Burton uses and doesn't, which ones he doesn't use. So anyway, that's sort of like a late night juxtaposition that I do just for myself. I don't think I leave it there for the morning for everybody to see it afterwards. But I'm back to
Tootsie,
and I'm back to Ron Carlisle. So I look up, I have my staff and I, we look up and then they print it out. And I have a lot of books that, they're books. You know, you turn the pages. I love books because you never know what, it's free associating. You can just keep looking, whereas in the computer, it will only spit out what you type in.
Right.
So this way, I love seeing what's, so we do sort of cheesy productions. I won't tell you which ones because sometimes I work on revivals of some of these. So I'm not going to tell you which ones from the, you know, that we have. Because Ron Carlisle is just, shall we say, slightly cheesy and inappropriate. So there's some of these. And it's the play within a play is Romeo and Juliet called Juliet's Curse. And again, spoiler alert, I'm sorry, I'm going to tell you. Juliet wakes up. She's not dead, and she falls for Romeo's brother. So that tells you it's already a different quirk.
Right.
So looking up, what would that production be? Okay, that's one whole thing you look up. Mm. And then the really hard part is when you get inside the brain of Michael Dorsey, who is the actor who becomes Dorothy Michaels, you get inside his brain and try to figure out how would he dress himself when he is playing the role in his mind, the ultimate method acting. How would he dress himself to be convincingly perceived as Dorothy Michaels? There are minefields all over this entire production. In fact,
because
when I
he's a straight guy,
he is,
so he's coming to it with that point of view.
He is, having dated many
women,
many girlfriends, many women, his whole life, having struck out with every one of them, as with all of his auditions, he's just a mess.
Right.
We know many people like this.
Sure.
And they're not hard to find. In fact, the Mirror some morning shows me one. And so trying to be sensitive about, as I said, these minefields of inappropriateness and behavior, because what he's doing, as many of the lines say early on, he's stealing a job from a woman.
Right.
In fact, his next-door neighbor, Sandy,
right,
who auditions for the same job.
Yeah.
So once you realize you're not going to get past these minefields, they're just going to be there every single minute of the day, what I tried to do is, and I did this on Santino, I went shopping and bought a lot of sort of inexpensive clothes-type things that people can wear who have his measurements.
Mm-hmm.
He came and stood in my studio. I have two floors of a button factory in Tribeca. And on the street-level floor, I have a, back in the back, I have a mirror from one of my restaurants.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yes, exactly. With stage lights on it. So it's very blinding, but that's what you're going to see. And we tried on different looks, what necklines, what sleeve lines, what waist lines. We padded out, obviously went to the corsetry store and bought all manner of things, shape-shifting,
right,
and tried all sorts of things way before I showed anything to the director, the brilliant Scott Ellis. And because Santino and I asked permission of Scott. I've done almost 25 shows with Scott Ellis. And he granted it, and I said, can we just mess around and then show you things. I said, and then I told Santino, we're not going to show anything that you, Santino, don't like. So we got like three pictures out of the first, and then we all looked at it and showed it to Scott, and then he said, oh, well, this looks this looks it. And onward for about five of these fittings. Nothing made, mind you. Still just, but a lot of things I would like drape on him and pull and hold.
Right.
Behind the,
see what,
you know,
looks ruffly and
yeah,
what looks
taut. Yeah, and how
taut
around the neck. And
yeah.
And so I discovered along the way many helpful things. I have to do a side comment about the Adam's apple. We all have this table have Adam's apples.
Is Fontino's pronounced?
Unpronounced.
Oh, you're kidding.
No. How lucky is that?
Yeah, you couldn't get luckier.
Because I'm guessing, and I have not done a study, because I did not go back and watch Tootsie the film. I remembered how hysterical it was from the beginning, and there are enough still pictures. I try not to look at the source material because then that's all you're going to do.
Right. You can't get it out of your head.
Right. And you can't get it's such a cultural, fabulous icon
right.
of, you know, comedy and just wrongness that we all love it so much. But Dustin Hoffman's character as Dorothy Michaels wore very high collars and ruffles.
And scarves
yeah. all around the neck. Well, on the Broadway and on... in opera and anything from a distance, the more skin you can show under the face, the better. And if you can't show skin, you need to show white
Why
collars.
Why is that?
You need to pull the face down. So there's more for the eye to find the face and to see the features. You need simple around it, and you need skin if you can, as low a neckline as you can get. It just helps you. Your eye ease into the face to discover all the nuances.
As an audience member.
If you're just like this and I'm holding my hands right under my chin, you only have chin to hairline to work with.
Right.
You don't have all of this, and you don't really have the ears and the neck.
Right.
So this was a huge discovery. Mm. So we started playing with how much can we open up his neck. This gave us so much more opportunity than they ever had before, and for my needs on stage, in order to find that face, mm-hmm. so you can study its malleable nuances, which you really need as much of that skin around the face for you to see it. You need to see ears, you need to see all this. And it was very helpful. That was huge. So we started playing with necklines.
I would imagine that this also helped Santino inform how he was going to start to play her. And
100%. And everything I've just said goes hand in hand with Santino and his process. I'm going to jump to, we then sat around, he and I, thinking of who are the designers that designed this. So I started pulling them out on memo and then trying them on like
right.
this.
Who are the designers that Dorothy would wear?
That Michael would buy for Dorothy. Now, we're not talking name brand super couture.
Right.
But their knockoffs in this fast fashion world, you can find them very quickly translated down. So he and I found it first, shared it with him, and I said, I think we're onto something. He said, I think we are. So I went further. Remember, nothing was just applied. It's all worth it. I was watching. Now, this is how long ago we were working on this, for 6 months already. I was watching Prince Harry's wedding to Meghan Markle, and I saw the dress she wore when she got out of the car for her rehearsal dinner. Mm. I don't know whether you remember it. It had asymmetrical neckline, a very tight-fitted waist, slightly high, and an asymmetrical handkerchief hemline. It was so flattering. Of course, anything she wears is flattering. But I thought, this will translate because I've got to straight across... Hemlines look dowdy on him.
Right. Oh, that's interesting.
And the dowdy is not where Michael Dorsey wanted Dorothy Michaels to go. So we started with Meghan Markle, and I have riffed on that one dress, not other dresses, just the one, and I have riffed on it throughout the entire evening.
I want to travel back in time to 9.
Oh.
And Anita Morris. And that wonderful dress or body stocking is
body
probably
suit.
More...
Cat suit.
Speaking of skim.
People right. called it a cat suit.
Which was scandalous in its day.
It was
day.
Scandalous.
And
now,
and
how did you know that? Did you stay up late to see the Tonys when you were 3?
I certainly did. I was a little old, I was a little older than 3, but that's sweet of you to say. So talk to us a little about that. It was a huge sensation. That outfit, all of those outfits.
It was unbelievable. I don't know what to say. I'm in such debt to Anita and to Tommy Toon. And to Maury Yeston, and to everyone who sort of was involved with that, Tommy Walsh, who actually got me the job, it isn't until our first fitting I found out that Miss Anita Morris is born and raised in Durham, North Carolina, 10 miles from William Ivy Long, born and raised in Raleigh, North Carolina. Who knew any of this was happening?
Kindred
we
spirits.
We didn't know that at all until we were open. But anyway, it all started with the desire of Fellini's film was in black and white. So the idea was to make the costumes all in black. The set by Lawrence Miller was going to be in white, and every bit of it was black and white and skin tone, except for Anita's hair. She had flame red hair. So the dress parade, because we had one, the process was just crazy. Sam's, or was it Charlie's? Which came first? It was torn down. It's right next to... It's on that corner right over there. Yeah. Anyway, 45th Street. 44th.
Oh,
45th
Sam's.
Street.
Sam's.
That's it.
Yeah, the bar.
That's right. And I drew all of the sketches on my napkins. And my assistant, Neil Spizak, just kept handing them to me. Now, keep going, keep going. Oh, I want another. And I would until I drew the entire thing, after avoiding it forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. And... So we started, then I had to turn them into big sketches because I had to show them Tommy Toot, and I'm not going to show napkins to Tommy Toot, you know, really. And so, but that broke the first curse and then showed him to Tommy. And then sort of, I mean, I'm not ready for the rest is history, but I don't have another 2 hours. But suffice it to say, well, I will talk specifically about Anita. So Anita, double-jointed, brilliant, genius, with Grover Dale, her husband, also such a talent. They created, with Tommy's leadership, her number on one of those boxes. And Anita pictured herself wearing a long sleeve turtleneck, up to here, to your chin, down to here, ruffle here, turtleneck, and long trousers in black. Mm-hmm. That's how she saw herself. Well, I did a sketch sort of a Vargas girl with a deep cut low here and sort of this and this, and we made it. It was a disaster, absolute disaster. It was horrible. And I remember she told Tommy, because she had no rapport with me at that time, especially since it was so terrible. She said, oh, I can't wear this. I want to wear my turtleneck and my pants that I've been rehearsing in and that you like. And so I had to go to Tommy, and Tommy announced to me that that's what she'd be wearing. And I said, could I please have one more try? One more try. He said, yes, but you know, she was very disappointed with that costume you made. I said, I know, so am I. So we made a bodysuit that went down to the knuckles and went up to the chin, and it was net. We didn't have stretch net back then. It was just black net, and then we made pants, and we went down to the ankles. So we made a turtleneck and trousers. And then I found that I started cutting out little pieces of lace and putting on it because I still wanted a see-through lace. She came in. Oh, boy, was it ugly. It was just horrible and not right. And she was, of course, very despondent. I was like, I realized my life was over because I had no brilliant solution for this brilliant performer.
Thinking they were going to fire you at any moment.
I would be gone, 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 gone. And then I had a light bulb, that one of those light bulb moments, and I went into the workroom, and I had a fabric that I was using on one of the Venetian capes as an overlay. It was black lace, and it had Renaissance swirls flocking on it. It was flocked on it. It didn't stretch at all. It was the stiffest thing you've ever seen. I brought it in and wrapped it around her. She started smiling, and we figured out a way to make this non-stretch into a top with an open keyhole back, for people who know what a keyhole in the back is. Under the belt, we had a 2-inch stretch so that there was a big, wide velvet belt that would stretch. And the rest we just cut the way you do, high in the crotch. So that, and she was double-jointed, so of course no pressure. This non-stretch net, stiff, prickly net. But she didn't care, stiff and prickly. It was what you saw. That was the fabric.
Pronto.
Signor Contini, telephone. Go ahead.
Guido.
was blazing around my bedroom when an idea occurred to me. I thought you might be wondering about Widow, who's not wearing any clothes. I'm not my darling, who's afraid to kiss your toes. I'm not your mama, dear, is blowing into your ear. So you're getting loud and clear. I need you to squeeze me here and here and here.
I had no idea it didn't stretch. I just assumed all of these years that, and so that all that stretching that it appeared was her body, basically.
It was her body
movements.
We cut seams under the, where you would cut under the bosom, darted right under there like you do, and the rest, and high gussets so the arms.
So she could move her arms.
Can do all of this. Yeah. I can't even do what she can do.
You're putting your arm over your head.
Yeah, my elbow on the top of my head.
Fairly successfully.
All of that cut in, that gusset cut in, and then the keyhole was the key.
Well, explain what a keyhole is. Yeah. Pretend we don't know what that is.
The keyhole. Well, here's the. There's her back. There's the shoulders, vertebra, waist, bottom, legs. See? And so, remember, that was the one stretch right there. That's the waist.
The waist.
Keyhole went there. And that's the back.
I see.
See? So the entire back could open up and then come back. When she had to stretch her arms around or do things, it would open up.
That gives you the mobility.
Give her the movement.
Right. But of course, well, you may add, children, we're going to adult point two here. She decided not to wear a bra.
Right.
Because you would see it underneath, and especially since the keyhole in the back opening.
Wait, did you design it with the idea that she'd wear a bra? Or did you not think that through?
Well, I built in the bra support, the underwire, as it were, support. I built that in, but only with a seam.
Right.
And it ended up only being a seam.
I guess what I'm asking is, as you were designing the dress, did you intend that her bosoms would be visible?
I didn't know where she would go
with it.
So
you were leaving it up to her.
I was, because remember, ladies' choice. Always the bra is ladies' choice. I'm never in the bra fittings. My lady assistants are in there with the ladies.
Right.
So we make sure we have a range, and what I have never argued with a bra choice.
Wow.
Whatever they come up with, we work with. Color, either black or nude, or what color nude, or white, or, you know, this. I say ladies' choice, and I've never in my life argued.
So
because that is a very important choice, and I'm not part of it.
Oh, that's that's very smart. So you didn't actually set out to design a scandalous outfit. It happened, really.
I designed to make a ladylike performing outfit because she was very ladylike. She's in Durham, North Carolina.
Yeah.
And her father's Dr. Morris, who delivered several of my friends. So, you know, we did not do a scandalous, because her performance was it was not salacious.
No, it was all about restraint.
It was about restraint.
Absolutely.
And it was a meeting of the minds and the luck of this fabric.
Kiss your feet, but little brow. Pinch your cheeks till you say ow. And I can hardly wait to show you.
Have to.
much.
I love you, Guido.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
I always say smiles after a fitting. There have to be smiles after a fitting. And you stay in that fitting until you get smiles. And sometimes you only get one thing done in a four-hour fitting. Right. And sometimes you get all of them done. You never know.
Because if you don't have a smile, you haven't done your job.
You haven't done your job, and you're not doing it. I keep a small yellow legal pad, one of those small ones like this size. What is that, 5 by 7? I keep that by my bed with a pen and our pencil. And literally, I wake up in the middle of the night. And, well, now that I'm older, I wake up in the middle of the night. Sorry. But even when I was younger, I would wake up in the middle of the night for no reason. And I would draw things. The most consistently vibrant waking up was on the original Chicago. Anne Ron King and all her changes as Roxy. I couldn't get them right. I couldn't figure them out. And they would come to me in the middle of the night. And she loved changes. She has like 6 or 8 changes in Chicago, whereas Bebe as Velma, 2.
Right.
Out of prison, in prison. That's it. But in prison, you know, Roxy's just going to flirtatiously change all the time. So we have lots of clothes for her. But getting them right, and you know, Anne's extension, her legs can hit her nose standing still.
Right.
And you know, those are the longest legs in captivity. I mean, there are no longer legs in Anne Ron King's. So you make a dress that doesn't frighten the children and the chickens, right? How do you do that? Well, you wake up in the middle of the night and you have ideas.
Speaking of Chicago, a show that's been running for 23 years.
All black costumes
again.
Are you
constantly in fittings? Because the cast changes so frequently.
I do fittings mostly on the principals these days.
Right.
When they bring in the revolving door of superstars.
Right.
When Barry Weisler surprises you with another improbable superstar who nails it. And I'm always there. Now we have a series of the classic looks.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all of them stay within a range. Even Mama Morton, whatever shot, it's a two-piece suit, sometimes mostly double-breasted, with a little bustier showing. That has sort of stayed. Velma has a little slip she opens with, a dress, and then a jacket. Roxy is the biggest variation. And I've got about 6 or 8, depending on how you vary, 6 or 8 variations. Different necklines, different backlines, different sleeve lengths, different lengths. And they're all out of the same lace. I bought yards and yards. And then several years in, we had in Lille, our lace is made in Lille, actually in those old looms. And we order 500 yards at a time. So every Roxy dress is out of the same lace, but interpreted to suit that lady. And sometimes it's big, wide necklaces. Sometimes it's a boat neck. And sometimes it's up to there's a turtleneck.
I would think age plays a factor in some
Not
of that.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
It's amazing what you can do with underpinnings. Because I do have some underpinnings under those the lace dresses. It's not just nothing. Like, not just Anita.
All the tricks. How long does 500 yards of lace last? That's a lot.
Well, it could last. Well, remember, we have different productions.
Right, so you have...
We're now entering... We're in our mid-50s of the number of productions. We just sent off... Now we have a super stock of clothing that we send out to say, from measurements, and we assign them. What they do when another country wants to do Chicago, I ask them to send us everyone in bathing suits, because you need to know everything.
The whole thing.
The men are in Speedos. They can have they're in Speedos, and the women are in two-piece or one-piece, whichever. But it shows me what I need to know, because those are see-through. It's for their benefit. One guy in a Swedish production recently sent a picture with a big baggy T-shirt. And we were like going ahead and assigning someone, because I have baggy T-shirt looks, too, that can help with the middle. I just look at myself and think, what would I wear in Chicago? And I have that available, readily available, with a big cummerbund to suck in the rest. I was assigning that one to this guy, and I said to my assistant, can we call up and email him and have another thing? Well, they sent back someone with an 8-pack. And I thought, well, I'm awfully glad I asked. Because, oh, I see, now we'll give a vest.
Right. This is the coffee table book I want, which is all of these photographs of all of the Chicago dancers in bathing suits over the history of the 20 years of the show.
They're fierce. They're fierce.
I can imagine.
And I don't ask for Billy Flynn or for Roxy or Velma or for Mama Morton. Because we have a range. Mama Morton, we have a range.
Right.
Billy Flynn wears a tuxedo. Amos, also, we don't ask for. And Velma and Roxy, we will tailor one of our classic looks to them.
To them.
They're gonna wait outside in line to get to see Roxy.
Think of those autographs I'll sign. Good luck to you, Roxy. And I'll appear in a lavalier that goes all the way down to my waist.
Here a ring, there a ring, everywhere a ring-a-ling.
But always in the best of taste. Ooh, I'm a star.
And the audience loves her.
And I love the audience, and the audience loves me for loving them, and I love the audience for loving me, and we just love each other. That's because none of us ever got enough love in our childhood.
That's right.
And that showbiz kid.
Oh, yeah.
I would think, because the people that come into Chicago are a wide range. You get Broadway veterans, you get people from television and film. I would imagine that you've had an experience with a Roxy or a Velma who may not come from a Broadway background, who has very specific ideas about what they want to look like that have nothing to do with the show.
You have just said in the fewest words, what I would have just said 15 minutes on. Thank you for that. That is exactly right. Part of the magic of the revolving door of Barry Weiser land is that you can have many people. For instance, Roxy's dancing is not Velma's dancing.
Right.
Velma has to be able to do some amazing...
The thing on the chair.
Exactly.
Right. Few people can do that.
Very few people can do it.
Then I thought I'd cry. Buckets! Only I don't have a handkerchief, and that's when I have to ask you for yours. I really like that part, don't you? Then I get up, and I try to walk. Oh, but I'm too weak. So I slump, and I slump, and I slump, and I slump, until finally I faint.
When she rolls her eyes, watch her take the prize when Velma takes the stand. When Velma takes the stand.
Rob and I just saw Chicago last week. And
oh, you did?
We did. Right. And I hadn't been in, I think, 16 years.
Oh my goodness, it had been a while.
Last time, I go every year. Rob goes every year. Last time I went, Melanie Griffith was Roxy.
Wasn't she great? She made me cry.
It was a really special performance. But my point is, sitting there last week in the theater and seeing those costumes, it's a marvelous to me that they don't look any different than my memory of them. Although hearing you describe them, they are very different, right?
They do change,
individualized for each
performer.
Well,
and different fabrics are no longer available. So the cut of different pants have to be different. So but I'm glad. So you're seeing a classic Chicago when you see it.
Absolutely. I did not know what you just said about the differences between the fabrics and the time and all of that. It makes sense, obviously, because 23 years is a long time.
It is.
But you've kept the integrity of what you did so many years ago.
Well, to that point, our first national tour, after we had been on Broadway, Charlotte d'Amboise was going to be Roxy and take that out. And different people. I remember three of the guys' name were Mark.
Right.
Anyway, there were three marks in it.
I think I saw Jasmine Guy in Chicago, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, you may have. Now, hold on. So, Walter Bobby, always the creative artist, says, why don't we just continue imagining what these people should wear? So I continued imagining, and we did different looks. We sort of kept the Roxy and Velma and Mama Mort. And the principle's the same, but I did variations. We open out of town. I forget where. It was some Masonic hall. The audience was loud. There was no internet at the time. And we got criticisms and complaints. And the producers called up Walter and said, well, Walter was there. And this is not working. And I called up Broadway and got the doubles. And the doubles went on the next day, and they've been on ever since. We had, unbeknownst to ourselves, created a Chicago look, even for the ensemble. And we didn't know it. We didn't know people were paying that much attention. So Go to Hell Kitty looks like Go to Hell Kitty. Hunyak looks like Hunyak. The full body stocking with the gypsy shawl, they wanted to see that. The Caitlin Carter look, which I call that, which is vinyl bra and panties under a full net body stocking. They wanted to see all that, and I had replaced them with different looks. And so they were back, and we learned our lesson. Oh, we didn't even know we had made a classic.
Your designs for that show, as we've been talking about, they are, I mean, those designs are part of the culture now, right? So when you talk about a Fosse look, that's the look that comes to mind with people now, are your designs
Isn't
for that,
that
Chicago.
Amazing? How
for
humbling that is. There's another example. Now, my mother, from her grave, will say, stop bragging, because I was encouraged not to brag, but of course, did it work? No. There's another that I'm told, because of course I'm bragging, full disclosure, I know I'm a disgusting and horrible person. But speaking of the people, the Candor and Ebb canon, there's another show called Cabaret.
Yes.
And another show starring in the original cast, Joel Grey. Mm-hmm. But I am told there is now a second look for the MC. So when people go out on Halloween, they have two choices for the MC. And I'm awfully proud to be part of that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Bragging. Yeah. So, but both Joel Grey, I mean, Cabaret and Chicago, Joel Grey, ladies and gentlemen.
Right. Yeah.
Should have been my name, Mr. Cellophane, 'cause you can look right through me, walk right by me, and never know I'm there. I tell you, Cellophane, Mr. Cellophane. Should have been my name, Mr. Cellophane, 'cause you can look right through me, walk right by me, and never know I'm there. Never even hope I didn't take up too much of your time.
Another costume designer who popped up when we were preparing for this interview was Willa Kim.
Oh, my great hero. Oh,
right.
My goodness.
Right. I was wondering if you could share with us how
you. Now, yeah. Willa wasn't just my hero. She was my dear friend. And we became friends in the 70s. Well, we became friends in the 80s. We met in the 70s. And she was my most frequent Tony-goer and theater-goer. And we've seen, you know, I would say hundreds of shows and events together. So Willa remains, and she will remain forever, as one of the great theater artists. She had an almost intuitive, based on great study and knowledge, but it's amazing what people call intuitive when really it's based on a lot of work. But I'm going to still say intuitive. Because she was so, she gave an impression of an ephemeral spirit that would come upon people, places, and things and have opinions and tuck them into her brain. She was very poetic. Mm. And then, but hard as nails and a workaholic. So, but what came out of this seemingly intuitive hard work is some of the most savvy, knowing dance costumes you will ever see, ever in the world. And we all, everyone within earshot who is old enough to have seen, for instance, Dancing, mm-hmm. and how she interpreted previously existing productions of other shows that were then excerpted in this one night only. Well, it ran for years, but it's to have been a celebration of Bob Fosse. She reimagined them without context of storytelling and who, what, when, where, and why. No one will ever, ever forget Sing, Sing, Sing,
right.
Our Steam Heat. It's just you can't understand. Where did those pom-poms come from, Willa?
Are those the ones that glowed, the things that glowed in the dark, those stripes?
All of those, too.
Oh.
Where did the bouncy things come from, Willa?
Right.
Where did the... And I will never forget it. And I had just begun to know her then. Just a little bit. And I was in the shop one day. And she had a bowl... She was sitting there. And she had a bowl of water and a white... I guess it was poster board back then. We didn't have push pin board. We didn't have a lot of things back then, so I don't know what it was. But now it would be push pin board.
Right.
And she had this pile, the shoppers had brought different pink fabrics, little swatches or big swatches or whatever. They weren't uniform. And there she was, dipping them in the water halfway and laying them on this white poster board. Dipping it like this size. What is this? This is a index card. Mm-hmm.
3x5.
She would dip, like I've done, written. She would dip this into the water, like I've just dipped it into my Tito's vodka. See, drying the, and she would place it over there. And she did this all together for an entire board through to see the wet and the dry. She was picking the pink shirts for one of the big dance numbers that men were wearing, the pink shirts, ties, and trousers, and she wanted to see what the sweat did to it.
Oh, my God.
Just think of the revelation. Because I have just dipped this piece, this card in vodka and laid it on the thing, and you can still see there's a difference
right.
in these. Grayer on this side. Mm-hmm. And she did this with like a dozen or two. I didn't stay around to see which one she picked.
Right.
But that's how she picked the pink for the shirts.
Wow. That's fascinating.
Doesn't that give you goosebumps?
Yeah, it really
does. That's a level of professionalism to which I aspire. Yeah. And I hope everybody who's listening aspires. Yeah. Because that's dealing with what it's going to be.
You've designed so many iconic costumes. We've talked about this at length. Is there a costume or a show that you wish you had designed that you didn't design?
There is... actually an answer to that. I am pea green with jealousy over many shows that I wish I had designed. Because they're just so delicious and they have such wonderful people in them. And damn, why wasn't I asked? So the list is so long, I don't really want to embarrass myself. But I will tell you that the current production of Moulin Rouge, designed by my colleague Catherine Zuber, I'm just pea green with envy.
Well, that's quite a compliment for you to be green with envy.
I'm green with envy.
That says it all.
Well, it had its colonel, Baz Luhrmann.
Right.
And the great Catherine Martin, CM, who designed the scenery and costumes.
Speaking of auteurs.
Speaking of that family. Can you imagine that kitchen table?
Right.
And actually, no, I can't imagine either of them in the kitchen.
A tall order.
But anyway, that's a potency to rival the recent Fosse Verdon that we all were thrilled with Tommy Cale's steering of that ship. Yeah. And so, of course, I would love to have been part of this that production. I'm very envious and very proud of them all, Derek McLean and Catherine Zuber.
It's quite a show. Well, finally, we ask everyone this question, so we will ask you, what was the show or program or thing that made you want to work in the theater?
Ah, I actually have an answer. I don't think I've said it out loud, but I've said it to the lady who designed it. I was in Chapel Hill and a PBS, Channel 13 or whatever it was down in North Carolina, PBS program was shown, black and white, and it was the Rossignol. And it was a Michael Schmuin choreographed ballet of the Rossignol. And it had been reset for television film. So there's a parade of the presentation of the Rossignol, the little mechanical bird, to the emperor. And then there's the various ballets and various things that happen around this presentation. And I remember, of course, eating up anything from the new Channel 13. Now, mind you, black and white, and it's the court of the Emperor of China. It's black and white. But it was shot on a white soundstage. And the first things you saw were the banners carried by people in, homage to chinoiserie, shall we just say, because it's westernized, chinoiserie garb, presenting this timeless story of the Rossignol, which is heartbreaking in many ways, but my heart wasn't broken because of the story. My heart was broken because of the beauty. And it was years and years. And then it exploded to the scenery and costumes on this white soundstage. In other words, the ballet audience didn't see it. It was reconfigured for this Theater in America, one of those early. And my heart exploded because even in black and white, the textures of velvet versus satin versus flat versus metallic, either gold or silver, and the complicated cloud motifs and the see-through butterflies that were carried and lit, and the parade, and designed by Willa Kim. Years later, I told her about it, and I started crying the way I'm feeling very emotional right now. And she didn't know what to do, because she was a crusty person. She was going to, this is not a... She wouldn't tear right up. I was tearing up in her living room, because I think she asked me some version of that. How did you first know about me? Not your question, which is much even bigger. What made you want to do this? And my answer is the Rossignol, PBS, Michael Schmuin, and you. She did the scenery, the props, and the costumes.
Wow.
In black and white.
But I think there's also a portion of our audience that don't understand what black and white television looked like, truly, and how magical that must have been for it to take a hold of you as strongly as it did.
In black and white.
In black and white.
It's a testament to the design.
It was the design. Well, you know, there are two sides of design through the ages. Disegno e colore. Disegno means line. Mm. Colore means color. In the 19th century, design was epitomized by angra and line. And colore Delacroix, known for the passion of the color. So it's also, Disegno is Apollonian. Colore is Dionysian. Apollo, Dionysus. These are the two sides. This, I would almost say, since we're talking about Rossignol, this is the yin and the yang. This is the two parts of all design. All choices have both. And the best choices have both. So I think I was seeing both in black and white. I did not know it was Willa until years later. Seriously, I didn't know it was Willa Kim.
Wow. And the profound effect that she would have on your entire adult life.
My entire life. I mean, we were so close for decades. I forget who said this. It wasn't Tony Wong, but it was somebody who said she lived to be either 99 or 101.
Yeah, it was 99.
Or 101. God love her.
God love her. Well, William, this was a real treat. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you for letting me talk about myself, and my mother would be so ashamed because I'm afraid I've been bragging and name-dropping and doing all the things that a nice Southern boy is not supposed to do.
Well, we are the benefit of your name-dropping.
I hope it's not too terrible.
No, thank you so much.
Thank you. Now I can finish my martini.
Yes.
Rob here with You May Be Wondering. During our conversation with William just now, we mentioned Willa Kim. You may be wondering who she was and how her legacy continues to this day. A legendary costume designer for ballet, theater, opera, and television, Willa Kim was born on June 30th, 1917, the daughter of Korean immigrants who operated a grocery store. Showing an early affinity for art, Willa set out to become a fashion illustrator and painter, studying her craft at Los Angeles City College and the California Institute of the Arts. In the 1940s, she briefly worked as a fashion illustrator at Macy's before moving to Paramount Studios to become an assistant to costume designer Raoul Penet Dubois, who would become her mentor and collaborator. She followed Raoul to New York to work behind the scenes on costumes on the original productions of Call Me Madam, Wonderful Town, Gypsy, The Music Man, and Bells Are Ringing, and even married his cousin, William. In the 1960s, Willa broke out on her own, enduring a string of flops on Broadway before hitting her stride with hit shows in the late 1970s through the 1990s, including Bob Fosse's Dancin' in 1978, Song and Dance in 1985, and of course, her Tony Award-winning designs for Duke Ellington's Sophisticated Ladies in 1981 and the Will Rogers Follies in 1991. Known for designing and crafting exuberant, fanciful, and over-the-top costumes that dazzled the eye and were central to creating theatrical spectacle, Willa was also a noted innovator, particularly in the world of dance, where she was strongly associated with Elliott Feld's ABT, the American Ballet Theater. She is credited with being the first costume designer to switch from heavy woolen nylon to lightweight stretched fabrics for dancers' costumes, and she was the first to hand-paint designs on those new fabrics. Willa entered the Theater Hall of Fame in 2007, before passing away in 2016 at the age of 99, following a long and full life defined by elegance in design and a dogged work ethic. If you're ever wondering if it's worth it to continue pursuing a dream or a goal, just remember that Willa Kim was in her 60s before she won her first Tony Award. As a way to honor her life's work as a pioneer, legend, and inspiration for many of today's theater artists, the Theater Communications Group, with support from the estate of Willa Kim, recently announced the inaugural recipients of the Willa Kim Costume Design Scholarship. This unique scholarship provides exceptionally talented costume designers who are enrolled in a university or a professional training program with up to $7,500 to be used towards tuition, registration, and/or supplies specifically earmarked for training in hand drawing and painting beyond the regular academic curriculum. As drafting software and other digital tools become increasingly advanced and ubiquitous, the goal of this scholarship's focus is to ensure that early career costume designers develop their skills in the arts of drafting and drawing by hand, something Willa was passionate about. Next time you see a show, any show, whether on Broadway or in your community, remember that someone designed, constructed, and/or assembled the costumes. That hours and hours of hard work and countless artistic decisions went into crafting the final products you see on stage. And that there is a long, proud tradition of costume design, extending from pioneers like Willa Kim to today's industry leaders like William Ivy Long and up-and-coming generations of designers who have yet to make their names. Together, these costume designers play a significant role in keeping the heart of the Fabulous Invalid beating for artists and audiences alike. Rob here. That's our show. Thanks for listening. You can hear us anytime on iTunes. The Fabulous Invalid is a production of O&M Etc. and the Fabulous Invalid LLC, and a proud member of the Broadway Podcast Network. Our theme music is by Lucky Chops. Today's episode was edited and engineered by Aaron Kaufman, and special thanks, as always, to Orso Restaurant for hosting us. You can find us online at thefabulousinvalid.com, and on social media at Fabulous Invalid, and on iTunes, Spotify, and wherever you find your podcasts. And be sure to tune in next Wednesday.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.